So to kick off this deep dive, we are going to start with a story.
Slightly grim one, to be honest.
Yeah, it is a bit grim, but stick with me here because it perfectly sets up the mental gymnastics we are about to attempt.
It really does.
Okay, so imagine Major Andre. For anyone rusty on their Revolutionary War history, he was the British officer who conspired with Benedict Arnold.
Right.
He was caught, and unfortunately for him, he was hanged as a spy.
A tragic figure, really, but a very clear-cut historical event.
Right, exactly. Now, if you asked a normal person, or even a literary heavyweight like, say, Jonathan Swift or George Bernard Shaw, what happened to Major Andre, they would just give you the facts.
Yeah, they'd say he was hanged.
Simple, active voice, done.
It conveys the necessary information perfectly well.
But then you step into the world of philosophy.
Oh, here we go.
Right, so if you asked F.H. Bradley, the famous British idealist, he'd get a bit more dramatic. He'd say, he was killed.
Right, which shift the focus slightly.
Yeah. And then you get Immanuel Kant. He'd probably push his glasses up his nose and say something incredibly dry, like, his mortal existence achieved its termination.
That is just classic Kant right there.
Oh.
Completely obsessed with the state of being and totally detached from the emotion of the actual event.
Right, totally detached. But then, and this is the punchline, then you ask Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel.
This is where the record violently scratches.
Exactly. Hegel looks at you deep in thought and says, a finite determination of infinity had been further determined by its own negation.
And that right there is why most people, when they see a 500-page book by Hegel, they just turn around and walk the other way.
I mean, a finite determination of infinity. It
Yeah.
literally sounds like a riddle from a bad fantasy novel.
It really is.
But here's the thing, and this is exactly why we are doing this deep dive today. Hegel has this reputation for being, the final boss of
The
philosophy.
defense, verbose, impossible.
Right. But our sources suggest that once you crack the code, once you understand his vocabulary, you realize he's not just trying to be annoying, he's actually trying to describe a moving target, and then it all starts to make
It
sense.
really does. And to be fair to Hegel here, he talks that way because he thinks our normal everyday language is broken.
How so?
Well, when we say he was hanged, we're taking a snapshot, click, frozen in time.
Okay.
But Hegel doesn't believe in snapshots. He believes in movies. He thinks reality is fundamentally a process. So when he talks about negation and determination, he's trying to describe the motion of reality, not just the end result.
Right. So our mission today for you listening is to decode that motion. We're going to look at Hegel's view of reality, which isn't just a static collection of things. It's a meandering, moving process of the mind.
Or what he calls spirit,
Right.
Geist in the original German. And it's important to note here that Geist translates as both mind and spirit. It's essentially consciousness in action.
Okay, so let's start with the big wrapper for all of this, the foundational concept, absolute idealism.
Yes. Now, usually when people hear the word idealism, they think of optimism. Like, oh, she's an idealist. She thinks the world is sunshine and rainbows.
It is definitely not that. In the realm of philosophy, idealism is the direct opposite of materialism.
Right. And materialism says the world is made of physical stuff,
Huh.
atoms, quarks, rocks. And our minds are just sort of accidental biological byproducts of that stuff.
Exactly. Hegel flips that completely upside down. He says the fundamental reality is thought. The material world is just the expression of that thought.
So wait, absolute idealism means everything is thought.
Basically, yes. He argues that every single individual event, every person, every historical moment is just an expression of one massive all-inclusive process, the absolute.
This is where it gets a little sci-fi for me. So instead of thinking of the universe as a giant machine where parts just bang into each other, Hegel sees it as one giant mind that is actively thinking.
Yeah, think of it like a fractal. You know how in a fractal, the pattern of the whole is repeated in every single tiny part? Sure, yeah. Like if
Yeah.
you zoom in on a snowflake, the tiny tip looks exactly like the whole snowflake.
Exactly. Hegel believes the structure of the universe, the macrocosm, is mirrored perfectly in the structure of our individual minds. The microcosm.
Okay.
So your self-consciousness, your ability to sit there and think, I am, isn't just a biological accident. It's actually a moment where the universe is becoming conscious of itself through you.
Wow, that really recontextualizes your Tuesday morning commute.
It does.
You aren't just a person stuck in traffic. You are the universe currently experiencing the concept of traffic.
In a very real way, yes.
Yeah.
And this is exactly why history matters so much to Hegel. He doesn't see history as just one damn thing after another.
Right.
He sees it as the autobiography of God. It's the absolute spirit slowly waking up, figuring itself out, and moving toward freedom.
And he didn't just talk about this in the abstract either. He pointed to a real historical guy to prove it, Napoleon Bonaparte.
Oh, yeah. This is one of the most famous moments in philosophy. So Hegel and Napoleon were actual contemporaries.
Right.
In 1806, Hegel is living in Jena. He is frantically finishing his masterpiece, The Phenomenology of Spirit. And literally, right outside his window, the Battle of Jena is raging. Napoleon is out there crushing the Prussian army.
Talk about a high-pressure deadline.
Seriously. And Hegel sees Napoleon riding his horse through the town. Later, he writes a letter to a friend and says he just saw the world soul on horseback.
Okay, we need to dig into this phrase because I think it's really easy to misinterpret. Was Hegel just a massive fanboy? Was he just impressed by military power? Because at the end of the day, Napoleon was a conqueror.
It wasn't just the raw power. It was what Napoleon represented at that exact moment in history. You have to remember, before Napoleon, Europe was deeply feudal.
Right, a patchwork of arbitrary local laws.
Exactly. Local lords, massive confusion, special privileges. Napoleon brought the Code Napoleon. He brought a rational, universal legal system.
He brought the ideals of the French Revolution.
Liberty, equality, fraternity. But he brought them on the tip of a sword.
So when Hegel sees him riding through town, he doesn't just see a military celebrity. He sees a literal shift in the operating system of humanity.
That's a brilliant way to put it. He sees what he calls the universal taking over the particular.
Meaning the old world of special privileges for particular people was dying.
Right. And a new world of universal laws for everyone was being born. Napoleon was just the vehicle for that shift. Hegel called individuals like this world historical figures. They're essentially the hands on the clock of history.
The source material we have uses this really visceral metaphor for this. It says the Napoleonic event was pregnant with the future.
Yes, and that specific word implies something organic. This is a massive key shift Hegel makes. Before him, a lot of thinkers viewed the world mechanistically.
Like the billiard balls. Ball A hits ball B. Pure cause and effect.
Exactly. Hegel says, no, look at biology instead. History is a plant. The seed contains the tree. The past contains the future.
So Napoleon wasn't a random accident. He was the natural blossoming of everything that came before him.
Precisely. It's an organic interrelatedness.
Okay, so if history is organic and it's rational, it means it's going somewhere. It actually has a point.
It does.
Which leads us directly to probably the most controversial tattoo you could possibly get if you're a philosophy student. The famous maxim.
Oh, yes.
The real is rational and the rational is real.
Well, the single sentence that launched 1,000 arguments.
I have to be completely honest here. When I first read that, my immediate reaction was just a hard no.
I think that's most people's reaction.
Because if the real is rational, that sounds suspiciously like he's saying everything that happens is good. Wars are real. Plagues are real. Horrific injustice is real. Is Hegel actually saying something like the Holocaust was rational? Because if he is, we have a major, major problem.
It is absolutely the biggest hurdle in understanding Hegel. And the short answer is no. He is not saying that every terrible event is good or morally right.
Okay, thank goodness. Yeah. But how does he justify the phrase then?
We have to look at the specific German terms he used. He makes a very sharp distinction between existence, which just means mere existence, and Wirklichkeit, which translates to actuality or reality.
Okay, unpack that for us. What is the difference between something simply existing and something being real with a capital R?
Let's use an analogy. Think of a typo in a beautifully written book. Does that typo exist?
Yeah, of course. It's right there printed on the page.
Right. But is it part of the actual meaning of the book? Is it part of the rational structure that the author intended to communicate?
No, it's just a mistake. It's noise.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For Hegel, a vast amount of what happens in the physical world, random crimes, accidents, errors, is just existence. It's the typo. It hasn't reached the level of reality.
Whoa, okay.
For something to be real or actual in the Hegelian sense, it has to embody a rational purpose. It has to actually fit into the developing logic of the spirit.
So a random murder exists, but it's not rational. But the law that punishes that murder, that law is rational. And therefore, Hegel would say it is actually more real than the crime itself.
You've got it perfectly. The law endures. The law represents the universal structure of freedom. The crime is just a fleeting negation of that structure. Hegel argues that over the long meandering arc of history, the typos get corrected. And the rationale becomes the real. The world slowly but surely conforms to reason.
That is surprisingly optimistic.
It is.
It suggests that reality isn't just random, terrifying chaos. It's a self-correcting system.
It is deeply optimistic in the macro sense, but it's also quite ruthless.
Hmm.
because it implies that the individual typos don't really matter in the grand scheme of things.
Sure.
If you happen to be an individual caught in the gears of history, Hegel's rationality might not feel very comforting to you at all.
Yeah, I can see that. And this whole idea connects directly to his major debate with Kant, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
Because Kant thought our minds had these built-in categories. Like, we were all walking around wearing permanent rose-colored glasses, and we impose order on a chaotic world. But Hegel seems to be saying, no, the order is actually out there.
Right. Kant was this subjective idealist. He thought the rationality was fundamentally inside our heads. Hegel is an objective idealist. He says, no, the rationality is literally in the fabric of the world.
So the reason math works to describe the movement of planets isn't just because humans invented a clever tool called math.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's because the planets themselves are moving according to a rational logic that inherently matches the rational logic of our minds. Mm. Hence, the rational is real.
This moves us perfectly into the how of it all. If reality is this massive, moving, organic, self-correcting process, how does it actually move? Because it clearly doesn't just slide forward smoothly.
Oh, definitely not. It stumbles. It meanders. Hegel's view of logic is completely nonlinear. It's dialectical.
Right, the famous dialectic. We usually hear this described as the triad: thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Now, I know some hardcore scholars point out that Hegel didn't use those three exact words all that often, but it's the standard model we use to understand him.
Yeah, it's by far the best shorthand we have.
Mm-hmm.
The core idea is that you start with a thesis. This is your initial state. But that state is always abstract. It's incomplete.
Okay.
So because it's incomplete, naturally generates its own opposite, the antithesis, the negation.
It creates its own pushback.
Exactly. And the tension, the active struggle between the thesis and the antithesis inevitably leads to a synthesis. And the synthesis preserves the best parts of both, but rises to a completely new, higher level.
Our source material has the absolute best analogy for this triad. It takes this incredibly high-minded German philosophy and brings it right down to the living room floor.
The baby analogy.
Yes, the baby. So let's look at the development of a human life through the lens of the dialectic. The thesis is the newborn baby.
The squealing, squalling baby.
Okay. Now, in the abstract, we say a human is a rational being. But if you are looking at a newborn, they aren't exactly doing calculus. They are pure immediate impulse.
They are immediate beings. They just exist. They are pure potential, but they are not actualized yet.
So for that baby to actually grow up and become rational, the babiness has to be negated. Enter the antithesis, the toilet-trained child.
The moment of absolute tragedy for the toddler. The child discovers the word no. They discover rules.
Yeah.
They suddenly realize that their immediate desires, like the desire to just go to the bathroom wherever and whenever they want, are being actively blocked by society, which in this case is their parents.
So this is the antithesis. It's a direct negation of their immediate freedom.
Exactly.
And from the kid's perspective, it feels like a total loss of freedom, right? They are miserable, but it's actually a necessary developmental step. Because if you stayed a baby forever, you wouldn't actually be free. You'd just be a slave to your bladder.
Precisely. You desperately need the discipline, the antithesis, to break that raw immediacy.
Yeah.
But the dialectic doesn't stop there.
Right. Because if you stayed in the antithesis phase forever, you'd just be a rigid robot blindly following rules.
Exactly. You need the synthesis.
Yeah.
The adult.
The adult is the self-regulating human. They don't need a parent to yell at them to tell them what to do. They have internalized the rules and made them their own.
And here is where we get to the magic word in Hegel's vocabulary.
Aufheben.
Aufheben.
It's a German word he absolutely loves. Because it simultaneously means two opposite things. It means to cancel, but it also means to preserve.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Right. So the adult has canceled the childishness, but has preserved the life and the vital energy of the child. The synthesis contains all the previous stages, but completely transcends them.
You know, this completely changes how I think about the word contradiction.
Mm.
Usually if I contradict myself or if I hit a massive roadblock in a project, I think something has gone terribly wrong, like error does not compute. But Hegel is saying the roadblock is actually the engine.
Yes. He explicitly calls contradiction the moving principle of the world.
If there is no friction, there is absolutely no movement. If you are perfectly content and completely unchallenged, which is the thesis state, you are stagnant. You actually need the antithesis. You need the crisis, the struggle, the doubt to push you into the synthesis.
That is actually incredibly comforting. It reframes struggle not as a personal failure, but as a structural necessity of reality. You literally cannot get to the synthesis without going through the messy, painful middle part.
And this logic applies to literally everything. Science works exactly this way. Politics works this way. A theory is proposed as a thesis. Someone runs an experiment and finds a massive flaw, which is the antithesis. And a completely new, better theory is formed, the synthesis. It is the heartbeat of the absolute.
Okay, now I want to pivot to the social and political side of this, because if we are all just parts of this giant, organic, moving whole, where does that leave me, the individual?
This is where we get into the concept of the windowless monads.
Which sounds like a really weird insult you'd yell at someone in traffic. Move your car, you windowless monad!
It does. It actually comes from Leibniz, who is another major philosopher. Leibniz thought of human souls as monads, which he defined as completely sealed units. Nothing comes in, nothing goes out. We are all just isolated, independent bubbles floating past each other.
That is a very lonely way to view the universe.
Yeah, Hegel completely hated it. He totally rejects this atomistic view. The idea that society is just a random pile of completely separate individuals, like grains of sand in a bucket.
Right.
He argues we are actually embodied universals. We are porous. I'm defined by you. You are defined by me.
The classic, no man is an island.
Exactly. But taken even further, I literally cannot be a teacher without a student. You cannot be a parent without a child. Our individual identities are constructed entirely through our relationships with the whole organism.
Which leads directly to a concept mentioned in the notes from F.H. Bradley, the idea of my station and its duty. It sounds very rigid, very British Downton Abbey.
It definitely is. The core idea is that since you are a part of this organic whole, your primary moral obligation in life isn't to follow your bliss or find your true self in isolation.
Right.
It's to understand your specific role within the organism, your station, and diligently fulfill the duties of that station.
So if the state is the physical body and I am the thumb, my only job is to be a really, really good thumb, not to suddenly decide I want to try being a kidney.
Right. And this brings us right to the edge of the political danger zone. Because if the whole is fundamentally more important than the part, and if the state is the actual manifestation of the divine spirit on earth, what happens to individual human rights?
Yeah, I can clearly see where this logic is heading. If the state is literally God walking on earth, you probably shouldn't be arguing with it.
Exactly. Hegel definitely leans toward conservatism here. He genuinely thinks the state represents the ultimate synthesis of individual freedom and universal order. So he's generally against revolution, at least after the French Revolution anyway.
Right.
But this line of thinking has a very dark historical lineage.
Okay, we have to talk about Giovanni Gentile. And just as a quick aside for you listening, we have to be completely clear here. We are just tracing the historical flow of these ideas based on our sources. We are absolutely not endorsing this political viewpoint. We are just reporting how the philosophy was adapted.
Right, absolutely. It's just history.
Yeah.
So Gentile was an Italian philosopher in the early 20th century. He was a neo-Hegelian.
Okay.
He took this specific idea that the individual is practically nothing without the state, and he ran as far as he could with it. He actually became known as the philosopher of fascism. He even ghostwrote The Doctrine of Fascism for Benito Mussolini.
Wow. So there is a direct philosophical line from Hegel's We Are All One Organic Whole.
Yeah.
Straight to the fascist motto of everything within the state, nothing outside the state.
It is the absolute shadow side of the philosophy. If you emphasize the collective whole too much, the individual can easily get crushed. Now, we have to be fair, Hegel himself was not a fascist. He believed the state fundamentally existed to protect human freedom. But his logic, if you strip away his original safeguards, can absolutely be used to justify authoritarianism. The idea that the real is rational can very quickly become a terrifying excuse for might makes right.
It is a razor-thin line, because on one hand, it's a beautiful thought to be deeply connected to a greater whole, but on the other hand, you really don't want to be completely dissolved by it.
That is the ultimate tension, and honestly, you could say that tension is a dialectic in itself. Individualism as the thesis versus collectivism as the antithesis, humanity is clearly still looking for the perfect synthesis there.
That is very true. So let's try to land this plane. We've gone from the hanging of Major Andre to the mind of God, through the trauma of toilet training toddlers, and ended up analyzing the roots of fascism.
Just a standard Tuesday in the world of philosophy.
Right. But if we zoom all the way out, what is the one single thing, the main takeaway, that you want someone listening to carry with them today?
It really all comes down to the process. Reality is not a static picture. It's a movie. And it's a movie that is entirely written in the language of contradiction.
The dialectic.
We are constantly moving from potential, which is the thesis, to struggle, which is the antithesis, to actualization, which is the synthesis. And then the second you hit that synthesis, it immediately becomes a brand new thesis and the entire process starts all over again.
I really do love the idea that we are just the universe meandering toward truth. It makes our personal mistakes feel so much less like catastrophic failures and more like necessary data points.
It connects right back to that baby example.
Yeah.
You simply cannot become a mature adult without surviving the terrible twos. You cannot have a global history of freedom without the brutal struggles against tyranny. The negative is strictly required to achieve the positive.
Which brings me to a final provocative thought for everyone listening to chew on. If Hegel is actually right, and we are all essentially just thoughts meandering in the mind of an absolute spirit, does that fundamentally change how you view your own internal conflicts?
It really should change it.
Because if you are feeling deeply torn right now, if you are feeling a massive contradiction in your life, maybe between your current job and your true passion, or between your family duty and your personal desire, Hegel wouldn't say, oh, you need to fix that immediately.
No, he would say, watch it. That tension isn't a bug in your life. It's the engine. You are just currently sitting right in the middle of an antithesis.
And the synthesis is inevitably coming. You just have to let the dialectical process play out.
Exactly. Keep meandering.
So our final challenge to you this week, look for the triad in your own life. Where are you stuck in the abstract thesis? Where are you actively fighting the negation of the antithesis? And can you spot the synthesis on the horizon? Thanks for diving deep with us today. We'll see you next time.